Stephen, School of Finance.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All yours.
For the record, Steve Meyer, Legislative Revenue Office. This afternoon, we have some orientation slides on School of Finance. You'll see lots of charts, lots of numbers, but I'm not going to stress the numbers too much. I prefer spending the time on methods and concepts, but there's lots of numbers here, too. So you'll have to help me set the pace in terms of when you want to go faster, slower, et cetera, and feel free to interrupt with questions at any time.
Use a lot of pictures for my colleagues to my right, if that's possible.
They're charts and graphs rather than pictures.
You know the difference between charts and graphs and pictures, Senator? I'm sorry, I digress.
Just an overview first of the size of school districts in total. Currently teaching about 550,000 students, employing over 36,000 teachers and classroom aides. We have about 12,000 support staff and 1,400 school sites in 198 school districts. These are just rounded numbers. I wasn't trying to be precise for any particular year, but they are fairly recent numbers. As part of the overview, I'll lay out a little bit in terms of the big picture for both funding on the funding side and on the expenditure side before getting down into the nitty-gritty. But we want to cover the K-12 equalization formula, the ESD equalization phase-in, a little bit on other funding outside the formula, deal with the local option as a separate topic, and then just a little bit on the numbers in the governor's balanced budget proposal. So those are the main topics that we'll be dealing with. So if the questions come before or after a certain session, well, we can deal with that at the time. The public side of it is both the school districts being the primary providers of the education service. There's also a few students in state schools. And then what we will talk about this afternoon will totally ignore the private side, but there are a sizable number of students in the private parochial system and the homeschooling system. The Department of Education used to ask the private institutions to report to them on the number of students. And they sent out questionnaires basically to all the private schools that they were aware of. But that has changed. They're not going to do that anymore. So over time, this private number is going to become less and less accurate. That's just a matter of staffing, not necessarily whether the information is really useful or not.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hand.
Steve, does students in private or parochial or homeschooling, do they count in the equation currently that is the average daily population for a school district, even though they are not attending that particular school district?
Senator Hannon, they do not count if they are going to a private or parochial school. It only deals with the numbers that you're talking about, the ADM or ADMW, only count students in the public school.
So is there a shift currently existing or going on between the public to the private? If we eliminate the private record keeping, and we're not going to know how much are we going to know about the shift that is going to occur between the public to the private?
We're not going to have a good idea of how much of that is happening. We may have some inkling in terms of comparing either the public to census data in the future or to the number of children that are between certain age groups from the population studies. That would be our only clue, I think, as to if that ratio is changing or not over time. There won't be direct information from the private schools.
Because the reason I'm asking that question is, as an example, in the Ashland School District, the cost of housing is rising, and the availability of students in the public school system is decreasing because of the cost of housing. So what it has done is created a cost shift you're raising more money but decreasing children, so the school support level is actually going down at the same time the cost locally is going up.
Mm-hmm. This won't identify those kinds of shifts, local shifts. But some of that is happening, yes.
Is it happening in other areas of the state?
I don't know, but I would guess that it is.
Okay, thank you.
Just looking at total resources, this is everything that's included in the school district budget. It's not just state dollars or property tax dollars. It's everything. You can see how those trends have increased over time. The local portion on the bottom is primarily property taxes, but it also includes fees and charges and some other local revenue. It's interesting to look at 96-97, when Measure 5 fully phased in. You can see the start of an increase in 96-97, but then in 97-98 it dips back down a little bit, and that's with the implementation of Measure 50 kicking in on the local side. And then you can see how much the state portion of the bar has expanded. That's from the state school fund, but it would also include the common school fund and state-managed county timber revenue from primarily from the Tillamook forest. So that's increased tremendously. The federal dollars have remained fairly constant, although you can see some increase in 2000-2001. The federal dollars would be the federal forest payments, the grants for special education and other special grants, and school lunch program money from the federal government.
Mr. Chair, I have a question on those. Does those federal funds that come in, do they go directly to school districts, or do they go through the formula? I believe they go through the formula.
Senator Starr, the dollars go directly to the school district.
Are they incorporated in the
federal dollars? Well, they pass through the state treasury, but they go directly to the school districts. But they are counted as local revenue in the school equalization formula. Okay. And we'll talk more about that later.
Mr. Kim?
Senator Ringo.
Could you estimate the amount of federal funds? Is it $300 million? Somewhere in that range? Just looking at that chart.
In 2000-2001, I think that would be a close guess. I don't have the numbers with me.
Yeah. And if we were not to comply with certain federal requirements, we would lose those.
Lose some of it. I don't know that you would lose all of it. It depends on which requirements.
I see.
School lunch dollars, for example. I don't know what the requirements are around that to participate.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hamm.
Following up on the Senator's question on timber tax, federal timber tax going into that equation, even though you show a larger contribution from the feds over what it used to be, there's a declining amount correspondingly with the timber, the loss of timber being harvested, is there not? And is that reflected in your color graph up there?
The federal government changed the way they pay or how they calculate the federal forest fee dollar total. And it's not based upon federal timber harvested anymore like it used to be. It's a payment that is currently based upon the...
In lieu of.
It's an in lieu of, but it's always been an in lieu of. Of a property tax on federal timber, since the state can't tax a federal property, but the federal dollars have increased, and there was an issue about that last session, whether the increased dollars should be included in the school formula or not, and it was decided that yes, all of the federal dollars, even the additional increased federal forest dollars, would be included in the formula. And by doing that, some districts had a substantial increase in their federal dollars, but then the way the formula works, the state dollars
would
normally be on top of that drop down and offset the federal increase in the federal dollars.
Yeah, I wanted to show that while the federal funds may be increasing in one regard, it's being offset in the state funds.
At the intermediate level, it's primarily the county school fund and any money the school district received from education service districts. And then also to note that the state and local categories here are different, defined differently than state and local in the formula. So what you see here for some of the dollars then will be what aren't considered local here, they will be considered local fund revenue in the formula. And it's just a difference of definition in which categories of dollars are put in.
Steve, do you know the breakdown, the percentages for local, state, and federal on the last bar, the 0001?
Oh, I do, but not with me.
We can get it later.
Yeah, state dominates it, but offhand, I can't recall the percentages. Okay, this slide deals with how the money is spent from the slide that you have just seen. Other than it doesn't include any balances and debt service dollars, it's for instruction and support only. You can divide this graph up into two different approaches. One is to look at instruction, the instruction share of it, and add the services and materials, the salary and benefits, and capital and other for instruction, and see that the instruction share is 54% of the total, roughly. And support 46%, or you can divide it up between salary and benefits and all other, for example, and add the salary and benefit 47% for instruction to the salary and benefit of 25% for support, and get salaries as about 72% of the total. You'll hear numbers higher than that 72% for salary and benefits. That's because I think that the comparison is to a smaller base. It's probably to operating revenue, so it wouldn't include capital dollars that are included here. So it's if you hear 80 or 85%, it's not because it's wrong, it's because it's on a narrower measure of operating revenue.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Thank you. Who compiled this data? Does this Department of Education...
The Department of Education gathers this information from the school districts themselves, from the school district audit reports. The school districts actually report over the internet, actually, to the Department of Education, and they do some verification work and put it all together.
The $4.4 billion that is represented in this particular graph includes all of the funds we saw in the previous graph, correct?
It does not include any balances and debt service. So this is a smaller amount than the total in the revenue slide. Some of the support services, just by way of reminder, are... If there's a social worker in the school district, a health worker, all the administration staff, transportation, food service, operations and maintenance, guidance, attendance, all those kinds of employees come under the support category. Okay, now we want to look a little bit about the dollars in the 0103 biennium and see what's happened there. Just a little bit in terms of background. The state school fund was adopted in 1991 after the passage of Measure 5. Don't want to dwell on Measure 5. You've had information about that from property tax material. But I did want to note that the Oregon Constitution that requires a uniform and general system of schools has not changed through this whole process. Going from the old school finance system to Measure 5 to Measure 50. The Constitution is still the same. And the challenges that have been made under the Constitution have not prevailed. The state has been able to successfully defend the existing system under the Constitution.
Mr. Kemp?
Senator Inga.
Just to clarify that,
have there been court cases that have held that our funding formula was unequal at any point?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
I mean, the court has recognized that it's unequal, but that was okay given the circumstances.
Yeah, not in an illegal way.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
The state school fund, this gives you the sources of revenue that get put into the state school fund. The general fund portion is 80%, the other 12% lottery, 8%. This is a little bit different than what you would find in prior biennials when the general fund was a higher percentage. As the 01-03 biennium progressed and the revenue problems reduced the amount of money for the general fund, the portion of the state school, or the portion of the general fund going into the state school fund dropped and was substituted by an increase in other fund sources. The other 12% includes the tobacco money that was put into the state school fund and some MUPL or Medicaid money that was put into the state school fund.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hamm.
Steve, the $4.5 billion, is that a reduction from the session level of 5.2 that was approved?
Yes, it is.
So actually, when you show the graph, this is after the reductions were made based upon the five special sessions rather than what was legislatively approved during the last session.
Correct.
How much of this graph is going to be impacted if Measure 28 passes tomorrow, and where does it cause the reduction to occur in the general fund?
If Measure 28 passes, this reflects Measure 28 failing. So this is kind of the worst case scenario as of where we're at right now.
Okay.
So the across the board cuts are not in here, and Measure 28 is not in these numbers.
Are you going to have a graph that shows that?
More money is going to be gone. No. Super Bowl.
I did not put one in for that. If Measure 28 passes, then there would be $95 million more in the general fund
category
into the state school fund to be distributed.
Thank you.
So, yeah, the 4.58 is hopefully the worst case scenario, at least until the March revenue forecast. Then looking at how it has changed during this biennium with the special sessions, what I've done is put a few slides in here that show the both years of the biennium for the different sources. This is the state school fund one. You can see that for 01-02 there was no change from the close of regular session, which is the COS abbreviation. But then for 02-03, being $2.54 billion at the close of the regular session and currently being at about $2.15 billion. Now, there's different ways of doing comparisons here. You can compare year to year, or you can compare close of regular session to now for 02-03. And rather than to try to give you all those kinds of percentages, I decided let's just wait and see what happens to Measure 28, because it all changed, or some of them have changed after that anyway. So I'm not going to try to put some percentages out there that would potentially change rather quickly. On the formula local revenue side in 01-03, there has been a couple of changes to the forecast. They haven't been very well publicized, but both before the first special session and then just recently in November, December, there were updates to the local revenue estimates for the biennium. You can see that for 01-02 there was just a real minor change, and for 02-03 a little bit more of a change, a drop, but not much, mostly because it was the drop in the property taxes and other local formula revenue was somewhat offset by the increase in the distribution from the school fund. There was $17.7 million special payment in 02-03 from that fund, and that's counted as local revenue in the equalization formula that helped offset some of the additional reductions in property taxes, primarily on the local revenue side. the and part of most of the reason for the drop in local revenue or property taxes is a change that we made in the collection factor. It's not how much is actually billed or imposed on the property tax statement, it's how much is actually collected by the school district for the community investment. Right. Then if you put the state and local revenue together, you get a little bit different picture. Again, virtually no change in 01-02, but in 02-03, going from 3.638 billion down to 3.235. It's a decline, but it's not, in total, it's less of a decline than if you are just looking at the state school fund, because you're adding all of the local revenue to that base for comparison.
Mr. Chairman?
Mm-hmm.
Where is the local revenue, the green or the blue? Or
no, the local and state here are combined. So the green is the current estimate. The bluish one is the close of regular session estimate. For
how much that local revenue, do you have a graph or a figure that shows how much local revenue has declined?
Yes. Well, here is the local revenue going from 1.095 billion to 1.08 billion.
That's local revenue?
Yes. So not much of a change.
So that's failure to pay taxes, postponing, senior deferral, any variety of combinations.
Right. A little bit slower growth in assessed value.
Uh-huh.
So all of those are things that affect the property taxes and other local revenue.
Okay, thank you.
The other new bit of information on this slide is that it shows you the change in the school improvement plan going from $108 million in 01-02 to zero in 02-03. So, again, the results you get depend on whether you include that change in the state school or the school improvement fund or not, along with your formula revenue. And I chose to leave it separate. Okay, then if we take those dollars and look at them on a per-weighted student basis, and a little bit later we'll get into more of the definition of ADMW, or average daily membership weighted. But here, just to show you that for 02-03, you can look at it either as a drop from the close of session number, about $5,500, down to $4,900, or you can look at it as a change from 01-02 of $5,350 to 02-03 of $4,935, depending on which comparisons you want to make. And again, you can do it with or without the $167 in the school improvement fund in 01-02 and zero in 02-03. So those are the kinds of changes we're looking at on a per-weighted student basis that's used in the formula.
Senator Starr.
Thank you. What's the number, ADMW? What's the total number? Total number of students is 550,000. What's the ADMW total number?
For 02-03, it's about 657,000, I believe.
Great. Thank you.
ADMW. Wait, yes. And that's an estimate, though, too. We don't have actuals.
Yeah, that's cost in the beginning.
Okay, then going back to the state school fund by itself.
These are real kids.
We usually think of the state school fund only going to school districts, and that's not quite the case, as this slide will show you. At least for 01-02, the appropriation was used for a couple other minor amounts for the disabled out-of-state placement students. These are students that are usually very severely handicapped, and so that the state either can't or doesn't have the kind of facilities that they need for their education, or what the facilities are in the state, there isn't room at that time for them, so they go out of state. And there's a special amount, $400,000 per year, that has been set aside out of the state school fund into that out-of-state placement fund. Another amount goes to small high schools. This last session, there was an amount paid to all of the small high schools of $200 per student to give them some extra funding. That was $9 million for the biennium, or $4.5 million per year.
Steve, do you know what the rationale for that decision was?
The argument was that small high schools had extra high costs because of their size. There wasn't efficiencies that the larger schools had. And with trying to implement CIMICAM and have a full program approach for small high school, just took extra money. Then there's the small amount for state special education. That's about $7.5 to $8 million a year. That helps fund hospital programs, educating students that are in hospitals or long-term care facilities, and it also provides some funding to the blind and deaf. So it transfers an amount to help pay state costs as though that student were in a school district. So there's about the same funding amount for those students that then is transferred for the state costs of providing those education programs. Then the bulk of it, of course, goes to K-12 school equalization formula, and within that formula you now have students that are in the youth corrections and detention program, so they are part of that total. The youth detention programs was adopted last biennium. The youth corrections, I believe, was 97, if I remember right. And then finally, a portion of it goes for the ESD equalization phase-in, and I can just, by way of historical information, ESDs did not receive any state school fund dollars prior to Measure 5. So it's only since Measure 5 that ESDs have shared out of the state school fund.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir Hannon.
The youth correction and detention programs, isn't there a budget across-the-board reduction in the Oregon Youth Authority for closure of some of the facilities, and what is the impact to the local school districts?
Senator Hannon, I'm not aware of that. It's probably on the fiscal side where that's happened. If it was cuts to the state program, then it probably didn't affect school districts directly.
Just state programs?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, this is just state programs.
Okay, thank you.
The local formula revenue is very specific sources. It's in the statutes. It's operating property taxes collected. Again, doesn't include bond property taxes. And it's dollars that are actually collected by the school district, not what's necessarily on the tax bill. So it takes into account, doesn't include any property taxes that are owed but not collected. The common school fund is, you know, even though it's a state fund, it's counted as local revenue, defined as part of local formula revenue. The county school fund, federal force revenue that we've talked about, the state managed county trust force, the Tillamook force dollars that we've talked about, and then grant and allow ESD funds shared. Grant and Willow are two ESDs that still operate under some ESD equalization statutes, where they serve as the levier of the property taxes and collector of the property taxes for their component school districts, and then shared that revenue out to the district. So it was equalization within the ESD is what was going on. But that's been phased out, and will go away with the phase-in of the ESD equalization process. That ends. And then there's a very minor amount of revenue in lieu of property taxes that's counted as local revenue. It's probably also important at this point to note what isn't included in local revenue for purposes of the formula. So we don't have any federal dollars included. No gifts, grants, donation type dollars, no interest rate that might be earned by the local school district on balances. If the school district sells property, that isn't included, that revenue source. So all of the voluntary type payments or receipts that school district might have are not included. All that you see in the definition here are compulsory payments under statute. If it was expanded to include voluntary sources of revenue, those sources would probably go away, because in effect that revenue would be counted in that school district. If it was counted as local revenue, then the state dollars would drop to offset, and that new local revenue in effect would be spread statewide among the rest of the school districts. So all of those voluntary payments so far have not been included in local revenue. This just gives you a few numbers, again, for 2001-03 biennium in terms of the amounts for the various categories that we've just talked about. And you can, but again, you can see the year-to-year changes. You can't see the close of session to current estimates for 2002-03 from this slide. One thing I would point out here, too, in terms of education service districts, why they have taken the drop they have in 2002-03 compared to 2001-02 is that when the school improvement funds went away for K-12 school districts, the ESDs didn't get any of those school improvement funds, but they said, well, the ESDs didn't get any of the school improvement funds, and so the ESD said, well, since the school districts are taking that reduction, we will share some of our state school funds with school districts. And so the ESD revenue went down by $4 million from the state school fund as a result of that, and that's reflected in the number, why you see the drop in 2002-03. This gives you the percentages of K-12 and ESD revenue by source. State school fund 68%, property taxes 29%, and local 3%. Normally you hear, and it's been true for several years, that the state school fund is 70%, local revenue is 30%. That was usually referring only to school districts, and so if you include education service districts, that changes that just a little bit under 70-30, but rounding it off, it would still be 70-30. So you can see now what has happened with the reductions in the state school fund. The state school fund's share of that total is dropping from roughly 68% from 70%. And that will probably change, or may change too, after tomorrow. Just for your information, last session and since 97, in the legislation there has been a revenue cap on what the total amount of state and local revenue can be for school districts each year. That was put into place in 97 primarily because we were just introducing Measure 50, new property tax system. We weren't sure how accurate our estimates were going to be for local revenue. And so there was some concern just how much revenue would be available to school districts if our estimate was way low. So they put on some caps that has continued to be the policy. And then if local revenue for some reason was higher than estimated, and so that you didn't need as much state school fund dollars, those state school fund dollars were siphoned off to help pay off the lottery-backed education bonds. And that happened for 3 years, but only 1 year was a significant amount of money. But the policy has continued, and these numbers are in the statutes now for 2001-03, but they're irrelevant at this stage. They will not be exceeded. All right. This would be a good time to just ask if there's any questions before going into the details of the equalization program. Okay. In 91, when the current funding was set into place, there was some basic principles that were agreed upon that should control how the formula was put together and how it would operate. The first was that the state school funding sources should be shared statewide. And so most of the local operating revenue, both state and local, is included in the formula. The second was to let each district decide how to spend its allocation, basically saying once you had the amount, that you would have local control and how to spend it. So the state aid is given in a lump sum, not in any categorical grants that would control what it had to be spent. Third, adjust funding only for uncontrollable cost differences. And the method then was to try to justify revenue differences in some rational manner, and that's when you get primarily into the weights and what the various weights are for various categories of students. The uncontrollable cost differences, for example, deal with transportation. The school district has no control upon where the students live within the district, where they have to transport them to school. The district, for example, has no control on the number of special education students that live in the district that they're responsible for. If it's a controllable cost difference, then it wasn't felt that that needed to be in the formula because the local district could change those costs if they chose to. Fourth was to avoid incentives to increase district allocation. Basically, the method was to have very few classifications and perhaps set limits within that classification to try to take away that incentive to reclassify a student or a program to hopefully qualify them for more funding. So those are the general principles, and I think you'll be able to see how they were built into the formula. The general format, the state and local revenue, again, operating revenue, from most sources, if not quite all, equals the number of students times a base funding per student and then takes into account various cost factors. So you'll see me coming back to this basic outline, but with details added as to how this general format was implemented. The cost factors are the student cost weights, teacher experience adjustment, transportation costs, and new facility grants. And we'll deal with each of these in more detail. So the next stage of the formula then is to say that state and local revenue equals a general purpose grant, a transportation grant, and a facility grant. The three different types of grants are to go back and deal with each of the cost factors that was in the last slide. But they're dealt with separately in these three grants. Okay, next we want to talk about the general purpose grant, how it's calculated, what kind of information you need. And students is a primary driver of how much is in that, how much the school district gets from the general purpose grant. It starts with a definition of average daily membership, which you can think of as an average enrollment in the district over the school year. And then if you talk about ADMR, that is simply ADM with kindergarten weighted at one half. The R really stands for resident. So it's the students in the district that are resident of the district that the district is responsible for providing an education service to.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Steve, the ADM of each district is reported by the district.
Correct.
Is there a standard method of considering what is the daily membership such that there's confidence that different districts aren't gaming the system?
There are detailed administrative rules put out by the Department of Education saying when is a student counted in average daily membership when it isn't.
Do districts follow those rules?
As far as I know, yeah.
Okay.
Except for the Beaverton factor, Mr. Chair.
that student count is part of the audit report. And so at the end of the school year, when the auditor comes in to review the records,
I see. Okay.
Part of the review.
Thank you.
Senator Farrelly.
Well, actually, my good colleague from Cottage Grove raises an interesting point. Do we have, Mr. Chairman, a list of the funding streams that don't fall under the formula?
I have mentioned some, but I haven't bothered to write them down.
Well, Mr. Chairman, could I suggest that the Chair request a list of those funding streams? Some of them are quite significant, even up to $30 million, that do not go into the ADMW formula.
Had the fight, son.
And so perhaps it'd just be, for the purposes of entertainment of the committee, if for no other purpose, to know where, you know, they say follow the money, Mr. Chairman. That's what we're supposed to do. So let's follow the money in this case and see where it comes from. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Then the ADMW is just the average daily membership with kindergarten weighted at 1/2, adjusted for further cost weights, and we'll list each of those in a moment. And we also have extended ADMW, which is simply the higher of the current year ADMW or the prior year ADMW. This was adopted primarily to help districts that have a declining enrollment or student count, so that they have a little additional time to adjust to a smaller student body. So they can use last year's weighted student count if this year's number is lower.
Huh. And then in this next year, they have to go to whatever. So they have a year grace period.
Yes.
Basically, to get there.
Right. And there's been proposals to extend that further back, at least in several of those last sessions. Okay, the weights for special education and at-risk students, you see listed there on the total being the total weight for the individual education program. This is the special education category. Each student counts as 2 students. The regular weight plus 1 additional weight for a total of 2. Students from families that are under the poverty level are weighted at 1 1/4. English as a second language or English language learners, if that's the new terminology, are weighted at 1 1/2. And you see the other 3 categories there as well.
Mr. Chair,
from Naringa. Now, are there limits to the extent a district can claim one of these weights?
Yes, there is. For the individual education program, there's a limit of 11% of your ADM. So no more than 11% of your students can be classified or included in your IEP weight at 2, unless, or if you have more than 11%, you can appeal to the Department of Education to include additional students at a 2 weight. But it goes through a review process, and then usually some percentage of all of the students that are requested as additional weighted students gets approved. So that's a process that takes place within the Department of Education. It's called the IEP waiver program.
Same for ESL?
No. There's no limit for ESL. So if your whole student body is ESL students, all of them would qualify for 1 1/2 weight.
Thank you.
I guess it's probably a good time here to point out, too, that with the additional funding generated by these weights, there's no requirement that the money be spent on those particular students that are generating the money. So if you have English as a second language and you're getting extra money for that, you may be spending that much for English as a second language program. You may be spending less. That's up to the district.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
Do some of these weighting reflect in, say, like 4 school districts? Do they get a heavier weighting average that have a lot of Hispanics or a lot of students in poverty, as an example? Does that substantially increase their amount that they're receiving per student?
It will increase the amount that they're receiving per student, yes. And how much more relative to their total dollars depends upon what percentage of their students qualify for that weight. you could have one district that gets a lot of additional money because of their poverty students at 1.25 weight. You could have another district that has a high percentage of English as a second language at 1.5 weight that then would end up with more money than maybe the district that has the poverty students because of the difference in the weights attached to those students.
I see. Has any discussion or consideration been given to merging school districts so as to combine some of these weighting scales?
There is a proposal to merge school districts. I think you'll probably... is it in the House or Senate side?
I don't know if we've gotten it aside.
But anyway, there is a proposal to merge school districts into the five congressional district areas.
Didn't go very far.
You'd have five school districts in the state?
That one's in the House.
That's in the House.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Starr,
and we thought the consolidation that occurred in the early 90s was something.
You ain't seen nothing yet.
There's no statutory requirement for further mergers of school districts or ESDs right now. The other thing to point out about these weights is that some of them are attached to individual students, like the IEP and English as a second language. You identify the student, you attach the weight to that student. The others here are group weights. You don't identify a student from a family in poverty and say that student qualifies for a 1.25 weight. That accounts for the poverty weight come from census data, and that's updated over time. For the pregnant and parenting, for example, the count comes from human services. So it's not all from the school district that are giving the counts. The Department of Human Services is giving the count to the school district and directly to the Department of Education. So again, that avoids an option there for the school district to control that total weight. Here you have a slide that gives you an idea of the counts of students in the various categories. I didn't write the numbers down in the bars, but you can see that special education is roughly 70,000 students. Not all that would qualify for the double weight because of the 11% cap and then the waiver process above that. English as a second language, about 50,000. Poverty, roughly 80,000, and then minor amounts in the other two categories. So heavily weighted in the poverty, ESL, and IEP categories.
Mr. Chair, is the special education the only one with a cap?
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Farrioli.
Steve, do we have these things mapped by geographic region?
No.
Okay, there's some anomalies that will become apparent as we go through a review of these situations. One of the things that you'll find is that the special ed kids tend to be more concentrated in the urban areas where they can receive much better specialized training and medical assistance. So they tend to be clustered, in fact, around OHSU and in the urban areas. What you find in the ESL is that you've got any fast-growing Latino or Asian population, you see a very high concentration. So we do have identifiable areas where the fastest-growing demographic, for instance, in Ontario and Hermiston, is English as a second language. So and that tends to group geographically. Poverty. If you look at the rural communities where the per capita income is half what it is in cities, you have a higher preponderance of poverty. And so this map, this bar graph, although there is no indication of geographic distribution, there are serious implications for geographic distribution.
Of course, we do have that information by school district. If you group school districts into those categories, urban, rural, however, then yes, you would begin seeing some of those patterns that you've described.
one of the things that we wrestle with and will continue to do is the patterns that are clear in geography and the patterns that are clear in the formulaic adjustments are supposed to work toward the middle. And they do at best, and at worst they don't. And that's part of the wrestling match, I think.
Here you have the revenue associated with those weights. If the regular unweighted student had a general purpose grant of $5,000, then the special education at double weight would have $10,000, and so on down the line. So there are dollars, those dollars associated with the weights.
Steve, are you aware, Mr. Chairman, please, if I may, are you aware of any special programs for pregnant and parenting kids? Or any special...
Not offhand, but I'm sure they exist.
I am aware.
Yeah, I'm
missing. I am aware.
Well, I know there's programs for prevention. I'm talking about
Mr. Chair.
Pregnant and parenting children.
Yeah, I know in the Hillsborough School District, for instance, there's a big, I don't know big, but there's a significant program for teenage mothers and within the school district.
Special high school.
So there is that opportunity.
Okay. I'm wondering if that's a program that exists primarily in the urban districts, because it's not something that school district administrators tell me about. It that exists in rural areas. Thank you.
John, do you know? You can just nod yes in rural or come testify.
Mr. Chairman, John Marshall with the Oregon School Boards Association. There are a variety of programs around the state, and as was suggested, larger school districts do have in-district programs that, for example, that offer child care.
Mm-hmm.
In some areas of the state, those programs are offered by ESDs. So they're really scattered depending on the number of pregnant and parenting students you have in the school.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
There's another cost weights that are associated with grades and the kind of school. As I mentioned, kindergarten is at 1/2. We still have a few elementary and union high school districts where the elementary students are weighted at 0.9 and the high school district at 1.2. That works out... If you do the math, then it works out to a weight of 1 for the 1 through 12 combination of the Union High and Elementary. The remote small schools, or the small school correction, as it's sometimes referred to, the total weight varies with the number of students, the number of grades served, and the size of the location of the school, the distance to the nearest school. Then we have a small high school phase-in, again, which varies, and I'll show you that to you a little bit more in the next slide.
Steve, I'm just aware of time, and we'll try. I know we've been asking a ton of questions, but we'll want to pick up.
Okay, the remote small high school, this gives you an idea of the additional weight depending on the size of the high school. It's assumed that it will have at least 40 students, and then it goes up to about 350 students. If you take a vertical line at any point for the size of the school, then the line in the darker portion of it under the weighted would be the additional weights added for that particular school. And this happens to be the example for a high school that's remote because it meets the 20-mile test. There's a phase-out in process for high schools for that additional weight. It used to be that it was reduced if the high school was relatively close to another small high school.
It was
between 10 and 20 miles. And that's currently being phased out so that it will just depend upon the size, not upon the distance of the nearest high school. And this just gives you some of the requirements when this was adopted. It's currently being phased in, and it's at 75% of the additional weight now if you don't meet the 20-mile test. Okay, after all of these weights, this will show you then the relationship between ADM and ADMW extended, how it's grown over time, and how much higher ADMW is than ADM. There's been a little bit of change in the definition that contributes to the growth of ADMW, with the youth corrections and juvenile corrections and the small high school weights being included now that weren't back there in 92, 93, for example, at the beginning of this comparison period. So you can see a fairly steady growth in ADM, but a faster growth in ADMW. The next item we need for the general purpose grant is the teacher experience adjustment. This is just $25 times the difference between the state average teacher experience level and the district average. So if the district is, for example, 1 year above the state average, it gets $25 more per weighted student. If the district average is 1 year less than the state, for example, it gets $25 less per weighted student.
So that's Chairman.
Senator Hannon.
Steve, there's a great deal of school teachers and administrators who are retiring under PERS and coming back as contract employees to school districts. And if I had a school district where there was a substantial amount of teachers coming back into the classroom as contract teachers, would that add to my district average experience? Because I have a higher age and longer experience.
Yes, assuming that those teachers coming back are the retirement age, which I think would be a safe assumption, then yes, they would probably add to their revenue because that would help make the district average higher relative to the state average.
Has those numbers been looked at? Because I don't know if it's happening in your school districts, but it's certainly happening in mine, where teachers and administrators, even the school superintendent Medford, retired last year and is on contract for this year, and his salary is just as high as it was before he went out on retirement or PERS. Mm. And all these things factor in on how much money comes back to a local school district on experience of the teachers.
The state average has dropped in the last couple of years, again reflecting retirements and the hiring of new teachers.
I do think that, Senator Hannon, that is a phenomenon. I certainly know that it's happening up north also, so I do think it's a phenomenon that might be statewide, and probably see that continue would be my guess, at least for the next 6 or 7 months.
The general purpose grant, then, to finally have all the information that we need to put it together, is ADMW extended times $4,500 as a target amount adjusted by that teacher experience, and then times a balance ratio. The balance ratio is no more than a number or a percent that distributes all the funds available in the state school fund and the local revenue. The $4,500 is just an arbitrary number that was picked back in 91, and the balance ratio back then was about 90%. Right now it's, depends on what year you use, but it's over 100%, about 110%, I think, for 0102. So you see that the general purpose grant is highly dependent upon the ADMW, and the weights then influence heavily how much money is directed towards that school district. Okay, the transportation costs, primarily for, as you know, transporting students between the home and the school, and the district has to provide transportation if it's more than a certain distance. I think there's one school district that still has a room and board school, and so they would have room and board in lieu of transportation, and the other kinds of transportation costs that qualify as approved costs. The grant then is 70% of those approved transportation costs. So a very simple, straightforward, kind of like a reimbursement policy for transportation costs. It probably said at 70%, I wasn't part of the process in 91, but probably set at 70% to provide some incentive for efficiencies. But again, if the school district reduces its transportation costs by a dollar, it only saves 30 cents. And if its transportation costs go up a dollar, it costs it 30 cents. Where does that 30 cents come from? since we're only looking at 70% of accrued transportation costs, it has to come back out of that general grant portion. So that general, those grant, general grant dollars aren't available for teachers, it's for transportation. But again, it does provide some incentive to control transportation costs. The chart shows you how that 70, well, both the 70% and 30%, how it's increased over time. It's currently at about $186 million in total, with the 70% being about $130 million that's included in the formula. The last grant, the facility grant, has certain costs that are eligible. It's limited to the cost of additional classrooms, whether it's new construction, additions, or portables, and it does not include any land cost for those classrooms. It goes back to when to measure 50, I guess, in terms of limited what bond revenue could be used for. And it was just basically for the structure, so that any of the components, the furnishings, the equipment used in the interior of the building didn't qualify for bonding. And so this was to, this facility grant was to help pay for those kinds of costs for providing additional classroom space. The grant itself is up to 8% of construction costs, and I say up to 8% because there's a cap on how much revenue can be used for this grant at $17.5 million in a biennium. That's by statute. And it's paid in the year that the school or the classroom space is first used. So it's limited by that $17.5 million. If you look at the distributions of facility grants, in the next slide you can see that roughly 30, 40 school districts, about 50 in 0203 qualify each year, but the amount that's given in grants can vary substantially from year to year because of how the cap comes into play. In 99-01, it was fairly equal between the 2 years, showing some growth, but in the 01-03 biennium, it's been very more unequal, and that can shift a couple $1 million a year into and out of general purpose grants, depending upon how high the facility grants are in that particular year. And the percent as well has been nowhere near 8%, about 5.6%. Last biennium, 3%. This biennium, and these are still estimates. They're not final numbers yet for 0103.
So those percentages are of total construction or construction on that particular project?
So all of the construction cost that qualifies statewide. Yes. And it would be the same percent for each school district.
Huh.
3% of their construction cost.
If they are building.
Right. Excuse me. Right, so if we go back into our same format, we've defined our general purpose grant, transportation grant, and facility grant. We have shown you how to do the calculation. This just has an example with a little bit of the detail. We got some water.
Oh, you got some. Okay.
Not using
it. Put it on the computer.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hannon.
On the local revenue, Steve, state revenue plus local revenue, the local revenue is only those funds raised by the school district?
It's all those revenues that was in that one slide that showed property taxes, common school fund, state school fund, state timber, that list.
I understand that. No. I'm going to ask you a question here that pertains to local school district in Ashland. They're talking about renewing a local revenue measure that is funded through the city parks that pays for student activities and sports. Is that included in the definition of local revenue, or is that outside and counted as additional revenue?
it's outside of the definition of local revenue.
So in essence, it's created like a local revenue, but it's additional revenue to what the equalization amount is.
Correct.
Okay, thank you. That's what Portland needs to do. No, that's what Portland needs to do for your
This GIL. Is a slide that will just give you an example of how the calculation might look for districts A, B, and C. They all start at the same $3,500 amount as the target. That amount is adjusted for their teacher experience, with A and B having 1 year above the state average, C being 1 year below. Adjusted to distribute all of the funds available, and then the 70% transportation costs added. So you can see even the totals, at least for B and C, are very close. You can see how various components of the grants may offset one another in terms of a district getting more in one category, a little bit less in another, and overall being relatively close on a weighted student basis. This illustrates how much of the funding comes from each of the three grants, with the general purpose grant being above 95%, education a little over 4%, and the facility grant less than 0.5%. Again, it gives you an idea of just how important those weights are in that general purpose grant. That's deciding where the money goes.
Mr. Chairman.
And the student count.
Senator Farrioli.
What's interesting about this pie chart is that the $3.1 billion is general fund revenue. But the transfer funds and other dollars that come into the system are just about double the size of this pie. So there's quite a bit more money here than is apparent from this formula, because we're just looking at general fund revenue here. We're looking at transfers as well?
We're looking at state and local.
So how do we get to...
state and local formula dollars.
Formula dollars.
Yes.
So how do we get to $5.2 billion or $5.1 billion in total school funding for K-12?
Part of it is ESDs, and it's for 2 years. This is 1 year.
Okay, so it's 6.2 is what we're looking at. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That clarifies it. This is an annual, on a biennial budget. Thank you. I was kind of wondering where the other half of the money was.
It never gets into the classroom. That's what my opponent said over and over again. It never gets into the classroom.
Feel free to proceed at any point.
Just remembering back to November, I'm sorry.
This slide is to remind you in terms of when the state school fund dollars are actually paid out to the school districts. The old system was to make a double payment in August and a triple payment in May, 25% in May, with nothing in July and June. Under the new distribution payment schedule that was adopted in the special session, you get a double payment in July and then in June, and a monthly payment for the rest of it.
It's called the Republican check writing scheme, I think, that slide.
Yes. Yeah, it doesn't look that much different to me. like light blue or dark blue.
But it speeds it up a little bit in terms of when the money's received with the double payment in July. Okay, just a couple slides on what the amounts look like from the formula revenue. If you look at total dollars, it's grown from a little over $2 billion to a little over $3 billion in this time period. The white boxes at the top of the bars beginning in 97-98 is funding outside of the formula revenue. It started out being $50 million for classroom needs. And then it went to lottery-backed bonds for capital improvements. And then in 01-02, it's the school improvement fund, and then nothing in 02-03. So that's the extra money that is there, but it's not formula revenue. Looking at it on a per-student basis, both for ADM and ADMW, you can see that it's grown lately, but then for 02-03, it drops off, but again, we don't know for sure just how much that will be. The the point here is to notice that the growth per ADM is a little bit faster than the growth per ADMW. And that's simply because ADMW itself grows faster than ADM, with the weighted student count increasing rather quickly.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Corcoran.
That seems to, John Marshall's here, he could probably correct me, but it seems to me that there's an argument made by the school community that the per student amount has not risen since, I thought they always used 90-91, but that shows that it's risen.
This doesn't adjust for inflation.
Okay.
It is the reason, this is just pure dollars that have increased.
And the inflation, then, you're looking at 3.9 versus, on the ADMW, 3.9 versus about 4.3. So with that, I guess my question would be, is that the amount of inflation that's taking place?
I don't have a slide here on inflation. If it depends on what years you use, what measure of inflation you use, and what student count you use, it all comes into play. You'll have more information on this a week from today.
Okay.
In terms of that historical comparison with that inflation. So I didn't put that slide in here.
Okay, thanks.
And I believe that varies. This will, the previous slide will vary. No, it's this one. Will vary by district.
Oh, yes.
Because I do know Portland, they've had 4% without adjusting for inflation growth since 1990, so just a straight up 4%. So you'll see wide variance in districts on that.
But also note that in 93, 94, there was a decrease. So we're not breaking entirely new ground in 02, 03. For funding equity, then, when I'm asked, is there equity in the school formula, I say basically that if the formula is the definition of equity, yes, there's equity. And the legislature, by adopting the formula, I think takes the position that that is their view of equity at that particular time, that version of the formula is in place. So it depends upon your definition, but in terms relative to the formula as the basis for the distribution, I think you, or at least I tell people that defines equity. And it applies to school districts. It doesn't apply to inputs or students or outcomes. You have to be clear on what you're equalizing. And it is a policy choice for the legislature, and it has changed over time and will continue to change, I expect. It's just a reminder of those aspects of the formula. This shows you how narrow the range is and how compact districts are around the average dollars per weighted student. There's not a lot of variation. The average here is about $5,100. You can see that roughly a third of the school districts are within $100 above and below that average. And again, this is on a district basis, not a student basis, so it doesn't tell you whether those districts represent a lot of the students or a few of the students. But at least, using districts as the basis, most of them are very near the average. But then you also have a few outliers because of the weights, like for small schools or the other weights, or the transportation costs can be substantially different per weighted student for some of the districts. So that gives them a little bit more or a little bit less money than near the average. Okay, any questions before moving on to education service districts? The phase in that was adopted last year. Okay. Just a little bit of background in terms of when ESDs merged. There's 21 ESDs now after the 95 merger legislation. There's no longer any legislation that would require further mergers, but there might be some voluntary mergers going forward. Just a quick look at the regions. Since most of the ESDs follow fairly closely the county boundaries, but not identical, it's fairly easy to put a map together to show you that most ESDs are made up of from 1 to 4 county territories.
How many total ESDs in Oregon?
21. There's some statutory purposes for ESDs, but generally it's hard to identify a particular package of services that all ESDs provide, although they are heavily into providing special education services. The sources are the same as for school districts, state school fund dollars, local property tax dollars primarily, and some federal funds. A few ESDs provide a substantial amount of contract services that they are paid for their costs that are not included in local revenue. So it's outside. It's kind of a reimbursement for services provided, whether it's to the component school districts or to another ESD or to school districts outside that particular ESD. But again, it varies substantially in terms of how much contract services an ESD will offer. Just give you a little bit of feel for the funding for education service districts for the biennium. State dollars were a little over $175 million. Excuse me, local dollars a little over $175. Local dollars being a little over $125 million. The amount below the line refers to the money transferred from the Grant and Malawi ESDs to their component school districts for their local equalization purposes. So it's not counted on the ESD side and the K-12 side. It's counted on the K-12 side to avoid double counting.
Steve, is there another... Mr. Chairman?
Sir Han.
Steve, is there another graph that shows the amount of federal funds that come into ESDs because they contract for special education and services such as that?
No, I don't have that showing up anywhere here. It's for ESDs, it's a fairly small amount.
Is it?
Because I don't know if any federal dollars go directly to the ESDs or it's funneled through the school district to the ESD. I'm not sure about that. They probably get some federal dollars, but I don't know. It's fairly minor, as I think, that are direct.
Okay.
The general logic for equalizing ESDs was something like this, although it wasn't written into any kind of policy. They provide services to school districts so that their costs are related to school district costs. And there's already a K-12 formula that takes into account those cost differences. So the ESDs should just receive an amount that's proportional to the school district formula revenue for their component school districts. Rather than reinvent a new formula just for ESDs, they decided to take this approach, primarily because it was hard to put together a bundle of services that all ESDs provide, or that you would want to require all ESDs to provide. Again, the same kind of format, state plus local revenue equals 8% of those of component school district from the revenue dollars. For the phase-in process, the 5 years, it was decided that the low-funded ESDs, well, the general approach was to say take the low-funded ESDs, set a target level that would be above their base and define a gap and then decide how quickly to close that gap over the 5 years. And the same way for high-funded ESDs, although for them, their base is above the target. They have to be brought down. That gap has to be reduced from the top down. So that was the approach. And it was the approach then was to reduce that gap by 20% per year for the high-funded ESDs. The way to do it was to make the state and local revenue equal to the base revenue plus a percent of the debt, plus or minus, depending on whether it's a high or low-funded district. And then also to set a dollar minimum for the ESD if the base adjustment didn't add up to a certain minimum amount for the whole district. And I'll give you the numbers for that in a moment. Part of defining ESD equalization was to define what the split should be between K-12 school districts and ESDs. Of the total local dollars available and of the total state school fund dollars, how much should each get? And it was decided that by 05-06, school districts should have 95%, ESDs should have 5% of that total fund. So you basically had to decide, well, how much do ESDs get, and then you could decide how much each ESD should get of that ESD total. The phase-in is, as you see on the next slide, what percent they get of their component school district revenue in 05-06, gradually increasing to 5%. The way it's calculated, though, it's 5.263% of the component school district's revenue, not 5% of the total. So the process is to take 95% for the school districts, run it through the formula, show how much each district should get, then sum that up for all of the school districts in each ESD and take 5.263% of it. So that the result is that 5.263% of the 95% equals 5%. So they are getting the 5% from this process. The base is just the higher of the revenue per student last year times this year's students, or the total state and local revenue for the prior year, whichever is the higher, times the base, and that gets adjusted each year. The high-funded ESDs, the way it's done is to take a percent of the gap for 02-03. It started in 01-02 with 20% reduction. 02-03, so that after that 20%, there's 80% left. And so in 02-03, you take 25% of that 80%, which is another 20%, and so on, until you've gone through the whole gap and then and reached full equalization in 05-06. The low-funded ESDs, it can be more than 20%, it can be less than 20%. The way it was ended up is that the low-funded ESDs get whatever percent of their gap is left after doing the high-funded ESDs, and whatever money is left after that process. Now, the estimates were, at the close of the session, was that it would be more than 20%, that the low-funded ESDs gap would be reduced more than 20%. Since all of the reduction in the state school funds, you would think, well, they won't get 20-some percent. It will be less than the close of session estimate. But you also have to keep in mind that the target has been lowered as well in terms of the formula revenue that those component school districts will have. And so that gap has narrowed, and so the percentage may still be close to what we thought it was at the close of regular session. So, But it was an open-ended for those low-funded ESDs in terms of just what would be left over for them. They were willing to take that risk. The district minimums started out at 700,000, increases to 1 million in 05-06. There's only one district that currently qualifies, and that's Lake ESD, which will make their amount per weighted student higher than the average and higher than most other districts, at least in 05-06. Okay, then full equalization is just 5.273% that we've talked about of that formula revenue for their component districts. Again, making the same kind of comments about ESD equity. Yes, there is equity if you accept the formula as defining that equity. And it applies, again, to ESDs, not to the school districts within the ESDs or students or outcomes or other things that might be considered for measuring equity. Hey, just a couple of comments about other funds, school improvement fund. Don't ask anything about that because there isn't any money there, as of now anyway. The stability fund, just to point out a couple of things. One is that the voters did approve that transfer of $150 million.
Steve, just one thing before. I wanted to, Senator Farioli, if you had any comments on the ESD, you led that effort. I didn't know if you might have any thoughts there.
Just that emblazoned on the orientation to ESD should be the words, abandon hope, all ye who enter here. It was very difficult to get a formula for equalization, and it does push people to the middle in 5 years, which is pretty short. I'm sure we haven't heard the last word on formulas. The interesting thing is that justice is a word with a different definition than equity. So people are falling on their swords for equity, and at the end of the day, they're not really happy with it. So, yeah, you'll get your chance, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
That's fine. The Education Stability Fund will have a $150 million transferred commit to the state school fund in May of this year. That should leave a balance of about $107 million at the end of this biennium. And there'll be an estimated $118 million additional lottery funds deposited in Oldfield 5, which should represent 18% of net lottery earnings. That was increased from 15%. The other components didn't change from the what was the endowment fund. Okay, then wanted to talk a little bit about local option. It was started in 1999 by Oslo 2753. It requires a voter approval, and it's limited to the tax gap, which is a tax gap, not a value gap. It's sometimes thought the amount or the length that the voters can approve varies with the use of the funds, whether it's operating or capital. And it can either be a fixed dollar rate or a dollar levy amount that the voters are asked to approve. The gap is just simply the difference between the major 50 tax on property and the major 5 tax on property. Using the $5 limit in Measure 5 on real market value. In Measure 50, that tax is whatever the permanent tax rate is for the district times assessed value. What's important to note is that if the gap allows it, the school district's going to ask voters to approve the full gap, but there's also a limit on the formula side. There's only so much of that local option revenue that can be raised before it starts to be included as local revenue in the school equalization formula. So there's no incentive to go above the cap. The cap is 10% of formula revenue or $500 per weighted student. So if the gap is large enough to raise more than the $500 or the 10% of formula revenue, there's no incentive to do it, because once it exceeds that, it becomes local revenue in the formula here statewide.
Yeah.
And for most school districts, it's the gap that controls, that sets the limit, not the 10% or $500.
Steve, do you know how many school districts have passed local options and the range?
Well, there's 14 districts that have a local option. There's three or four new ones that were approved. Well, I think let's go to the next slide or two, and we'll come to that. This is just gives you a visual of the gap versus the 10% and $500. The $500 under the current law, assuming that the state school fund grows over time, the $500 will be the limit, the controlling limit of those two, because the state local revenue will go back above $5,000 per student, so 10% of that would be less, or excuse me, would be more than $500. So, I'm sorry. If the state school fund does increase substantially, then we go to the 10%. But you can't. But that would then be more than 500. So eventually, you'll get to the 500 being the controlling. Controlling cap. Trying to get that state of money. Okay, the elections. I just have the 01 and 02 elections. A total of 5 passing, or 19% of the elections. So the passage rate has not been very high. last session, there were 14 districts that had a local option. These passed. There may have been a couple of those districts that only had a local option for one or 2 years that may drop off, or they may be in, may have asked voters to renew it and be in these 5. I'm not sure. So somewhere between, you know, around 15 to 20 is probably the number that we have now. Local option equalization. This is helps school districts that can get voter approval, and but that have low assessed value per student. So they're a property poor district, in effect, what we used to call property poor districts. The calculation is to take and the numbers of assessed value per student for all school districts, rank them from high to low, and find out where the 75th percent district lies in that ranking. Right, I can't tell you what the district mean is, but last session the assessed value was a little over 400,000 per student in that process. That was the 75th percentile amount. So that districts that had assessed value per student below that 411,000 qualified for an equalization grant. But there were only 3 of them that qualified out of that 14 last session.
Oh, that actually passed the local option.
Well, that met the assessed value per student test that were below the target.
Uh-huh.
The other 11 had assessed value per student above the 411,000. So they did not qualify for any local option equalization dollars.
And do you know what, of those 3 that were in the bottom 25%, just a ballpark figure, what the dollar amount correction or grant was?
The funds available was lowered during the special session to $450,000 for the biennium for both years.
So $450,000 was about the money that went to those.
Yes, that was available for their equalization. And if that money is not sufficient, then there's a reduction, pro rata reduction for those 3 to not exceed the $450,000 available. Okay, and the grant then is the EDM times that district's tax rate times the target assessed value per student less the district assessed value per student. So if a district makes a certain tax rate effort to raise revenue, this assures them that that rate then will, or that the revenue raised will at least be equivalent of that tax rate times the targeted assessed value per student that they will raise on a per student basis. So it's some incentive to help get approval for local options for those low property tax districts. Okay, then to quickly wrap up with the 0305 biennium balanced budget numbers. Total, the governor's balanced budget has $5.05 billion for the state school fund. And $550,000 actually for local option equalization. So just for those two funds.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir Hannon.
Steve, could you go back to that previous slide? The governor's 0305 biennium budget is 5.05. Now, does that compare to the current biennium of 5.2?
Yes.
So when you showed it,
I'm sorry. The 5.2 I think included a little bit more than just the state school fund, if I remember correctly.
Okay, but when you showed us earlier in your presentation today, it was down to 5.4.
4.7 something, I believe.
So I'm trying to find what is the actual increase.
Let's see.
It was 4.58 billion.
Mm-hmm. So I think that number probably included some school improvement dollars and some other, perhaps some other revenue.
K-12 and ESD revenue.
Right.
So when we see this number at 5.05, are we comparing apples and apples or apples and oranges?
This is just state school fund dollars, so we have to be sure that we're comparing it just to state school fund dollars for 01.
And what was it in the previous biennium?
It started out, and it started, it's about 4.7 some billion, I think, now. It was close to, it was around 5 billion at close to regular session.
Perhaps Wednesday, because I think it would be helpful Wednesday, but once we have the electoral results, would be helpful to look at exactly that question.
Yeah, I'm trying to see where is the yardstick taking us. Are we talking about an increase when, in fact, it isn't an increase, it's a net loss?
Mm-hmm. Biennium to biennium, there will be an increase.
But when you deduct all these five special sessions and measure 28 out, it's a net loss.
Let me back up. When I said increase, I meant after the special session adjustments.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd like to do that.
We're clear about that after the special session.
Pardon me?
I'd like to do that Wednesday, just get an apples to apples.
Yeah, because I feel like we're floating all these numbers here, and I'm not sure if we're getting an actual picture of what we're really talking about dollar-wise.
Yeah. So Wednesday, when we do the Measure 8, 28 results, we'll include that in as an apples to apples of where we are with the governors versus where we are. Senator Stark.
I'm just looking at slide number 19. It seems to me to be the comparison to this governor's number. If you add up those, the 01, 02, and 02, 03 numbers, seems to be the slide, unless I'm missing something, seems to be the slide that most closely compares. And at the current numbers, if you add those two together, it'd be 4.581, if I did my math correctly.
Right. If you're looking at the close of regular session, it's about almost $5 billion, the 2.4 and 2.5. And if you look at currently, it's 2.4 plus 2.2, 4.6. So
4.6.
Yeah, roughly.
And, well, with 28.
And compare that to the 5.05 growth real fast.
That'll have 28 money out. That's 95 money taken out.
That's gone.
So just about even at for a close of regular session, but higher than after the special session reduction.
Mm-hmm.
For just the state school fund portion. Okay, then if we start adding local revenue to that amount for 0305, you have 7.3 billion. For the biennium. And then if we break that apart between school districts and ESDs, school districts will have about 6.95 billion of that total, and ESDs will have about 346 million. So when we're talking about ESDs, we're talking about hundreds of millions. For school districts, we're talking about billions. Again, it's that 95% roughly split between the two. Okay, and just as a way of a reminder then, if there's no legislative action, the ESD phase-in will continue, the small school distance phase-in adjustment will continue, there wouldn't be any changes in the weights, there wouldn't be any change in local revenue sources, no new out-of-state placement funds, although there is funds in the ending balance that would carry over into the next biennium for that. There wouldn't be any new funding for small high school those the $200 per student, and no school improvement funds. So to do any of those, or to continue any of those programs or funding, will require additional legislation.
I asked Steve to prepare this slide just for you, Mr. Chair.
He did not.
I did not.
No.
He knows that.
Steve, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
For a very cogent presentation. Senator Corcoran, there will be an extended version beginning at 3 if you wish to stay. We'll do.
Luckily, I have General Government Committee. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Comments?
See the equivalent of staying after school, is that what you're saying?
Tomorrow we have excise taxes. Then Wednesday we get the results of Measure 28 Plus. We've invited testimony from, who is it, AFL-CIO, Tim Nesbitt,
Chuck
Sheketoff,
Joe Schweinhart
from AOI.
This is all Wednesday?
All Wednesday. And J.L. Wilson from NFIB to give us their perspective on revenue and revenue options before this legislature. Thank you, Steve. And
you're welcome.
Our adjournment.